This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, where I go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, politicians, and visionaries who are making the 21st century more libertarian, or at least more interesting, by challenging worn-out ideas and orthodoxies. Today's guest is Joe Dolce, whose new book is Modern Psychedelics, The Handbook for Mindful Exploration. Dolce argues that psychedelics aren't just the province of hippies or tech bros anymore. They are powerful and increasingly popular and legal tools for therapy, self-discovery, and play. We cover everything from the misunderstood role of ketamine in Friends star Matthew Perry's death to why ibogaine may be the only substance on earth that can stop addiction cold, to how we went from just say no campaigns to mail order magic mushrooms in just a few short decades. Here is The Reason Interview with Joe Dolce. Joe Dolce, thanks for talking to Reason.
I love talking to Reason. Thanks, right. Nick.
The new book is Modern Psychedelics, The Handbook for Mindful Exploration. Why did you feel a need to write this book now?
Well, for several reasons, really. The first was I like to be a little bit subversive, and I thought no matter what happens with psychedelics and the laws and the regulations, that we, people, need to know how to use them mindfully, skillfully, right. Either word.
Okay? In an informed way.
In an informed way. And, you know, I've used psychedelics since I was, 20? Mm-hmm. I went to college in Chicago, which was a major hub of MDMA distribution mm-hmm. in the 1970s and 80s. So I was exposed a lot. And, you know, I've used them a lot in various periods of my life, but really without any knowledge. Right. And so that was one reason. Number two reason was my own categories feeling a little hardened, a little stuck, okay? When mm-hmm. you get to a certain age, habit overcomes a sense of exploration. Mm-hmm. We get stuck in our own ways. And I thought, you know, I don't want to get to be that ossified old person. I don't want to be my grandfather, right? So I started using psychedelics again with that intention to sort of open up a little more wonder and a little more surprise in my life. And thought, you know, I should probably know a little bit more about them at this point. The third reason was I wrote this book, Brave New Weed, about 7 mm-hmm. years ago, which was not a bestseller, but it turned out to be a gateway book. So people started asking me questions about psychedelics, thinking I knew about all substances because I happened to know a lot about weed. And I didn't know the answers. Like, will ayahuasca interfere with your heart condition? Mm-hmm. Is there too much MDA you can take to have a bad experience? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a million questions, right? What the hell is ibogaine? And I didn't know the answer. So I thought, all right, well, maybe there is an opportunity for, a single source of truth in a book format. I'm old-fashioned. I like books.
Yeah.
I've looked at the Arrowhead site. It's really hard to navigate.
It's a very good site.
It's a great site.
A long-running site that has great information about everything about drugs, legal and illegal. But yeah, this, if I'm dating myself as well, but the cover of this book of Modern Psychedelics is such a great callback to kind of Peter Max. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it so pleasant and happy. Is this how you feel when you think about psychedelics?
Yeah, it is actually. And it feels optimistic, mm-hmm. which I think is, not every psychedelic experience you leave with that feeling, that's for sure. But I think overall, psychedelics are great teachers, mm-hmm. right? And I enjoy learning. So
what do they teach? Because at one point, you mentioned the fact, and this is widely believed within the psychedelic community, that psychedelics don't give you insight per se. They're kind of non-specific amplifiers. So they kind of make you more who you are going to be anyway, or what you're thinking. But so how do psychedelics teach?
I think they open up lateral ways of thinking. Okay, so we tend to think in a logical, direct way, a goal and a path to that goal. I think psychedelics are in that way very subversive. They show you all sorts of things, right? That they offer you different avenues of attention, really, that are as Huxley said, our mind reducing, the valve that we have to keep input out, so much input out, doesn't allow. Mm-hmm. So I think psychedelics do open up those doors.
How do you define psychedelics?
Psychedelics are unlike, I don't know if I have a simple answer for this. Yeah. They're unlike pharmaceuticals. So pharmaceuticals act on one specific site in the same way every time. Psychedelics are very unpredictable, right? They are very interesting in that they come from both plants and labs, right? That is so curious, right? Like, how did people in the Amazon know? There's 40,000 plant species in the Amazon, right? How did those folks figure out, oh, we mix this one and that one and we get ayahuasca?
Right.
No one knows the answer to this question. I mean, the curanderos say the plants told them, and really that's about the only evidence we have to be true.
And then we have the account of Albert Hofmann, the inventor of LSD, or a lab-based LSD. Mm-hmm. So we know how he came across it, but even that was basically an accident.
An accident, right? Yeah. I mean, ketamine as a psychedelic was an accident, right? It was developed as an anesthetic.
Right. For battlefields.
And by the way, like, I know ketamine gets a bad rap these days because of Elon and all sorts of other nefarious propaganda, but ketamine was so safe that they gave it to soldiers in the Vietnam War. Everybody had two syringes they carried in their pocket. If you were my buddy and you got hit, boom, I could inject you and you would not die.
Right.
No skill required, right? I could numb your pain for an hour or two until the MVAC
and
got there.
Ketamine is also used as an anesthetic for children in every hospital in the country because it doesn't mess with your heart rate the way that other things like fentanyl, which is also in every hospital in the country, does.
That's another way I will define psychedelics is they are, by and large, incredibly safe to use, right? I mean, most of the drug-related fatalities that come with psychedelics are because of fentanyl, because of tainted medications, or in the case of ketamine, because of extreme overuse. I'm talking extreme overuse.
We'll come back to some more general questions, but since we're talking about ketamine, and you write about this in the book, did Matthew Perry die because of ketamine?
Poor Matthew Perry.
Yeah, explain that, because this, I want to get to the larger point that you make early in the book, which is that we're on the cusp of accepting psychedelics and a lot of other things that, you know, when we were younger, there's no way these things would ever be allowed.
Oh, my God. Legally. I mean, did you think you were going to fry your brain? I mean, I used them, but I was pretty sure I was going to fry my brain.
Well, it was a cost. You would be like, okay, well, I'm going to have children with, you know, three eyes and flipper hands or something. But, you know, you got to make your choices.
You know,
or that they would never, you know, they would never be legal. Even weed, how, you know, it was hard in the 70s, certainly, to see, or maybe in the 80s, to see a legal path forward for weed because it had come so close and then it was definitively shot down. But let's talk about ketamine, because this is a drug. It started as an anesthetic, as you're talking about. And now, to the extent that most people know about it, it's because Elon Musk sniffs a lot in public interviews and seems kind of crazy. And we were told that it killed beloved friend star Matthew Perry.
That was the headline.
Yeah.
The New York Times wrote that.
Is that right?
It is wrong. It is absolutely wrong. Matthew Perry, poor guy, he had 10 times the therapeutic dose of ketamine in his system. 10 times. He was on buprenorphine, which is an anti-addiction drug. He was in a hot tub. So this mix of chemicals and and pure stupidity, really, you should not be in a hot tub with ketamine. It's very clear because you can pass out. Ultimately, water killed Matthew Perry. He drowned. Okay, ketamine has never been shown to kill anybody. It's very hard to kill somebody with ketamine, probably. I mean, I don't. There's been over also 900 clinical studies attesting to the safety. 900. Okay, no drug goes to that level of experimental testing. So
why does ketamine get such a bad rap? Is it, you know, and this is kind of an example that we can apply to other drugs. Is it because it's kind of new? It's kind of dangerous. Nobody really knows what it is.
It's kind of new. It's kind of legal also. Yeah. So every time, there's this interesting sweep, right? When psychedelics, there's an interesting problem. So LSD was created in 1942. I think that was the same year the atom bomb was created, right?
I think it was, wasn't it synthesized in 38?
But it was put on the
tried put on the accidentally shelf. In 42. Yeah, administered in 42.
And there seems to be this correlation, like terrible things happening in the world, and the advent of a psychedelic, right? Which has a lot of optimism, which is very interesting, and you can think about it however you want to think about it, right? And I, you know, we're at a similar moment in time right now where the world seems quite dire, and yet psychedelics are having this moment. And I worry, I don't want us to go into that same cycle again, right? I'm trying to, you know, constrain hype and keep hope, you know.
Hope, not hype,
okay. But a moderated hope.
Yeah.
Because there's so many questions if the governments do legalize psychedelics, like who controls them, who gets access, will they try to turn them into, you know, the kind of medicines that you have to take every day for the rest of your life, and will that destroy the beauty of a psychedelic?
So staying with ketamine a little bit, ketamine is approved for certain conditions, for depression particularly, and you can take it in a spray form, in a lozenge, you can get injections and do treatments that way. Explain how ketamine works therapeutically. Like, you know, what's the model behind that? Why does ketamine help people with depression?
It hits a lot of receptors in the system, which are too complicated to really go into, I think. It basically gives people a vacation from their own thinking. So you get a break from your own ruminative thought, the same thoughts that can really drive you into depression. And they think that depressives have a lot of ruminative thinking, right? So the same cycle of thinking occurs. And some theories compare it to like tracks in the snow, like if you're cross-country skiing.
Like you've worn grooves in your neurology. And these are all metaphors, but you've worn grooves in your brain and your I deserve to be depressed, or I'm not worthy of anything, or the world is a terrible place. And like,
you can't get out of that track, right? And psychedelics, including ketamine, seem to blur those snowy tracks and get you out of your mind for a bit. Ketamine is interesting because it has a very short window. It's called a critical period, a short window of change possibility. So ketamine is the shortest acting psychedelic. It only takes like 30 minutes. A typical session is 30 minutes to an hour. But that window of opportunity to learn new things or rethink is only about 2 to 4 days.
Right. And you point out in the book, I mean, this is true of all psychedelics, or this is the belief of how psychedelics open up your mind, is that you take a psychedelic and it kind of scrambles your circuit, or it doesn't scramble anything. Let's say, using the snow metaphor, it covers over the track so that you can maybe go different places. The shorter the drug trip is, basically, the shorter the window is to kind of really do the kind of therapeutic work or introspective work to change the way you think and feel and behave.
Yeah, that's the research of Gould Dolan, who's a fantastic neuroscientist now at Berkeley. She worked at Johns Hopkins for a long time. She learned through fantastic, she's a brilliant person. I just interviewed her in San Francisco, actually. And she can explain neuroscience. She's one of the few people that can really translate neuroscience into plain English. And I don't like to talk in neuroscience because I think it's just so complicated. And actually, I don't even have the skill to really explain the details of it. So I like these metaphors. I like talking about it metaphorically. So she's done research that shows it isn't the strength of the psychedelic that opens that critical period of learning. It's the length of the journey. So ketamine has the shortest. Ibogaine, which is an extraordinary anti-addictive drug, extraordinary, from Gabon in West Africa. It's a 36 to 72 hour trip, which, you know, I don't know if I'm
strong enough for it. Most vacations don't last that long, or at least not the good parts.
I can't imagine doing it, but it is the only substance we have on Earth that actually stops addiction right then and there. And it is thought to also stop most relapse.
Yeah,
and there is no medicine on Earth that does that.
Do we, you know, what's the reigning theory for how it does that? You know, within the psychedelic framework, like, okay, it lays down fresh snow, so something new happens. But then with ibogaine, and I know a lot of people, I have not myself taken it. I know people who have. I know addicts who have taken it, and, you know, they say, like, it stops the urges.
Right then and there. Like, you come out of that journey, and it never comes back. So it works on a million receptors, kappa, opioid. Mm-hmm. I mean, receptors that have just even been discovered. We don't have any idea of the receptor mm-hmm. mix on what this is doing. But we do know that it is very powerful. And I know some vets who've used it. It also works on
veterans.
Veterans, I mean to say. Yep. Not veterinarians.
Well, now the reason I was thinking is we were talking about ketamine, which is, you know, would be called Special K, and people would be like, well, you know, it's a horse tranquilizer. You're taking horse tranquilizer, and it's...
and
it's
it
like
is.
Well, every drug like that is used by one mammal is used by another.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, there's also horse ibuprofen, but
we don't demonize
substances that way. And it was created for humans, not horses.
Correct.
But in any case,
I've lost my train of thinking.
So how does Ibogaine kind of, you know, stop, you know, the most deep-seated addictions that we seem to know.
I was going to say it also works for traumatic brain injury,
right?
Which is super interesting because a lot of veterans,
yeah.
Have these traumatic, right. And it sounds awful. Like it really sounds like it destroys your life. You lose mm-hmm. when you have TBI. You lose all sorts of control, and you're mm-hmm. prone to incredible outbursts of anger, sometimes violence. People say they just don't know themselves anymore, mm-hmm. and it ruins marriages. A lot of veterans can't come back,
right.
really.
How did Ibogaine come into, you know, I don't want to say common use, but it's a known thing now. And, you know, people like Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, mm-hmm. Who was in Trump's first cabinet, is one of the biggest pushers of Ibogaine. And he says, you know, this has saved the lives of many people who I know who served in, you know, various wars. How did Ibogaine go from being this kind of rumored in crazy drug from Africa, from the bark of a tree or a bush in Africa, to now the VA is talking about possibly using?
Well, I actually think that Perry was very instrumental mm-hmm. in helping people think about that. Okay, also, Ibogaine has one big problem, which is that it expands what's called the Q interval of the heart. Okay, mm-hmm. So if you have a heart condition, it can be absolutely dangerous, perhaps mm-hmm. fatal. So the good news for people who want to control psychedelics is that you have to go through a lot of heart screenings before you get the ability to have Ibogaine, all right? So it is controllable in that way, right? Chances are you and I are not buying it off the street.
Right.
Although we could.
Yeah.
Get the iboga from the plant, which mm-hmm. apparently is mailed.
And, you know, I've been seeing in Instagram, if you know, it's the ultimate place for ads.
Of course.
And I've been getting, you know, Ibogaine-derived drops, ads for this kind of stuff. I have no idea if there's any Ibogaine in it at all.
Well, to go off the topic and not answer your question,
yeah.
there are two groups I know in Tepoztlan, Mexico. Mm-hmm. Tepoztlan is now the healing capital mm-hmm. of Mexico, and it's a very interesting and lovely little village. But they're doing microdosing with Ibogaine. Mm-hmm. So you connect with them.
Yeah.
Somehow magically the Ibogaine, the iboga powder, excuse me, from the plant itself gets mailed to you. And then you do online microdosing Ibogaine sessions with them and integration sessions. And apparently it's unlike other psychedelics in that it's very clarifying. Mm. Apparently it gives you a way forward in your life. Isn't that interesting?
Mm. Yeah.
Every description I've heard is it shows you a slideshow of your life, where things went wrong, and then a path forward.
Wow.
What is that?
So like a PowerPoint now. We don't use slideshows anymore, right?
PowerPoint.
That's like Kodak carousels.
Technicolor
or whatever, right? Or Kodachrome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Microdosing is using what is typically termed a sub-perceptual dose mm-hmm. of a psychedelic. Which means that you don't really
feel it.
Like, if you're microdosing LSD, you're not like, you know, going through crazy trips or seeing swirls in the air. Do you believe that it works?
Oh, I've been using it for 4 years as microdose.
Okay,
yes.
And what do you microdose in?
LSD.
Yeah.
I did it yesterday.
Okay.
So you do it every 3 days. It is sub-perceptual.
Yeah.
So, and the funny thing about LSD and probably with psilocybin, if you take too much, it's really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like you feel like itchy brain and the screen is all wavy and it's very hard to do what you want mm-hmm. to do. You have to wait way too long. So that's how you know you've taken too much. And the word microdose is really misused, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you can buy now little mushroom gummies and they'll be mm-hmm. called microdose, but they're not.
Right.
They're creating a feeling. So you want to get right below that feeling level. This was part of the ways that I, one of the reasons I came back to psychedelics is that I love like being a person of a certain age and not having to macrodose, right? Mm-hmm. Yet, what I get from microdosing is energy, mm-hmm. motivation. I get to my desk earlier right. and I'm happier to be there because mm-hmm. sometimes it's, you know, you don't really just want to go to work in the morning. But it makes all those things really fun mm-hmm. and really more approachable for me. And for other microdoses, I know other people say it gives them better workouts. They mm-hmm. have more energy to work out. I think it's a great thing for people over 50 if you feel it. I mean, people do it. Some people say it gives them nothing. A friend of mine in England tried it, and she was having such an uncomfortable experience. And then we realized that the average dose of LSD in England is still the Hoffman dose, 250 micrograms, right. as opposed to the United States, which is about 100 micrograms, right? That's interesting also. The community itself has really learned a lot. Like our hippie elders were quite wise. And I try to include some of that in the mm-hmm. book also. I don't want to dismiss these folks. Mm-hmm. So they figured out 250 micrograms, that's too much.
Yeah.
And that can drive people to emergency rooms and they freak out mm-hmm. more easily. So the world, the underground community has taken it upon itself to drop the dose of LSD to 100 micrograms.
Well, this goes back to places like Arrowhead where this stuff is all illegal, but there is a vast samizdat network yeah. of, you know, information sources. But what's good about your book is this, it's very clear, it's very comprehensive as well as comprehensible, if that's a word.
No, I tried to make, look, I tried to make this stuff accessible because it can be very arcane mm-hmm. and, you know, I love Arrowhead, but going through it is complicated and right. challenging, and you don't know. It's hard to know when things were posted. Like, was mm-hmm. it last year? Was it 20 years ago? Right. And things are changing, right? Yeah. I'm expecting I'll have to, if this book works, I'll have to do a second edition probably in three or 4 years. Let's inshallah it works, right? Yeah. But information is changing fast, so fast.
So we've talked we've talked about kind of psychedelics as an intervention for people who have like a chronic or an acute problem like mm-hmm. addiction or, you know, deep depression, and they might help. Then we've talked about it in a, I don't want to quite say therapeutic, but in a kind of optimizer speak of like, you know, what's good about microdosing
yeah.
LSD is like, I'm working better. I'm working out better.
Yeah.
The third function or broad function, and there's more than three, but of psychedelics is to blow your mind, not because you're an addict or you're depressed, but because like I wanna see what the far end of Pluto looks
yeah.
like. Can you talk about that? And how do you address it in the book?
Well, I'm trying to draw a line between the spirit and the science, mm-hmm. okay? Because psychedelics are, I think a lot of people will say, somewhat mystical,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I am not religious in any way, meaning I don't-
Meaning that you were raised Catholic and
I was raised
anymore.
Catholic and I practice meditation and I sit in silence every 2 years. But I try not to be stuck in patterns of mm-hmm. rigid thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's like one of my goals in mm-hmm. life. And I think religion is a sort of rigid-based mm-hmm. set of rules, right? So I try not to be religious about it. Yet, people who use psychedelics often will say it's a mystical experience, that there's an ineffability about it. There's a fundamental truth. There's a connection mm-hmm. to a greater whole, right? And that's one of the things that I love about psychedelics and one of the things that is hard to come across in everyday life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people will laugh. It's like, oh yeah, I was looking at the waves and I became the wave on the beach.
Mm.
And I can really relate to that.
Yeah.
It's like, I want that connection. And this is one of the ways that they do make me feel optimistic mm-hmm. in that it enables us to connect with the greater good and mm-hmm. the greater sense that we are not that different from the tree, from the waves, mm-hmm. from the rock.
From other people.
And from other people.
Right.
Right? And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Right? If we can overcome our political, religious, economic, mm-hmm. racial, gender, blah, 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 yeah. blah, 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 categories
right.
of difference.
And have that moment of kind of feeling yeah. unified.
We are together. We are of the same thing.
Right.
And this planet we live on is also of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And look, I don't know if psychedelics are the way to a new consciousness. Mm-hmm. But I will speak personally, and maybe you can speak. For me, they have expanded my consciousness mm-hmm. about that, and they always have. How about you?
Yeah, thank you for asking. You know, the way I think about them is I think when I first did psychedelics in high school, I guess, partly because my high school had a bunch of old, I was in high school in the late 70s and early 80s, we had a bunch of really old health movies that showed hippies taking LSD, and they were, you know, they were scare movies, and they were like, for just $1 or $2 it hit, you know, you get a drug that will last 10 or 12 hours. And everybody in the health class was like, oh my God, that's the greatest value drug of all time. You know, and then it was like, yeah, and your kids are going to be fucked up. But it was like, we weren't thinking about that then. What I find that psychedelics do for me now is they kind of reset. I liken it to, you know, starting my computer after it kind of gets kludgy. Mm-hmm. Just kind of clears the cache, you know, of the web browser and things like that.
Yeah,
I'm not convinced that there is a specific insight that they yield. Although I agree that that sense of unity is pleasing. And then you in the book you say, you know, don't forget about play or don't forget to play. That seems to be one of the messages of psychedelics, which is that, you know, they kind of give you permission to loosen up a little bit and get outside of yourself.
But play is interesting, right? Mm-hmm. We think of play as entertainment. Mm-hmm. This is another word that somebody whose name I'm forgetting created. It was called entheotainment, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think play can also be dealing with things that are difficult.
Yeah.
Like writing a book.
Right.
It's really not that much fun, mm-hmm. but it is somehow deeply satisfying once you figure out how the hell you're going to do it, right? And once you understand what it is. So for me, that's a sense of play. Mm-hmm. Like, believe me, writing a book for me, it's a hobby. It's not a means to an income. It's not a career, but it's a hobby. And that's play.
Yeah.
So everybody gets to define play differently, mm-hmm. right? Some people like to draw or sing or act or just mm-hmm. dance, really. And they don't do it naturally mm-hmm. in life. But boy, use a psychedelic and these things become, they feel much more natural. They feel much more basic, don't they?
Before we continue with the Reason interview, I want to ask you to help make this podcast and all Reason podcasts better. Please fill out our audience survey. It's only going to take a couple of minutes and I'll give you a chance to win a $300 gift card. The link to the survey is in the show notes for this episode. It'll really help us out. And now, back to the Reason interview.
Do you sense, I mean, and you've been, you're old enough to know to have been an adult or a drug taker in the 70s.
Yes.
So, you know, that's not the 50s when LSD was being widely used by therapists to treat alcoholism. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of scientific work being done on that. It wasn't the 60s where, you know, they became a way of escaping, I don't, you know, the death cult, as you know, of menopausal men who rule the world, as Timothy Leary would talk about the people who, you know, the greatest generation, essentially, of which he was a part. Do you feel like there is a generational difference? Do baby boomers experience psychedelics differently than Gen Z or all the
really
different
good
groups?
Question, and I don't know the answer. I think they're less afraid. Mm-hmm. I think we were more afraid in mm-hmm. some level. But I don't. I really don't know the answer to that. What do you think? Have you noticed
any
difference?
Yeah, well, I don't have. I mean, one thing that I like about the psychedelic community actually is that it seems to be the one place in my life where people of different ages come and
together.
Meet without it being hierarchical. It's not like going to college or going to church. Like, old people are not always in charge or droning on endlessly, but they're respected, and young people are, you know, are open without also kind of, you know, putting down boomers all the time or anything. So it's a different place, right?
It's so interesting because I have nephews who I trip with.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's like, at first I was like, oh, should I be doing this? And they were like, come on, Joe, let's go. Yeah.
Well,
let's go to the forest.
the other thing, as long as we're talking about it, one thing that I find very different is I feel like if you are, say, Gen X or older, you thought it, you came of age in a world that was much more structured and it's not that it's not rigid now, but it was like there were a lot of like Monday through Friday you wear a jacket and tie and you go to work and you play by the rules and you don't wear your wear your hat backwards, et cetera. And what psychedelics do is they kind of gave you a respite from that kind of conformity. But younger people have grown up in a world that is so much more plentiful and abundant that they don't have the same kind of structures to kind of melt with acid.
They don't, but they
that they don't have their own issues.
They do, but their screens are their issue. Yeah, yeah. Like, how do they get relief from that structured stuff coming at them all the time?
Right.
And I think psychedelics, you don't really want to look at your screen too often because you can't.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah,
that actually blurs it, right?
What do you think explains, at the start of the book, you do talk about, I wrote it down, that we're at a tipping point of acceptance of psychedelics, and that's with all of the scare stories about ketamine or about, there was that story, I can't remember if it was Spirit Airlines or, of a pilot who had taken mushrooms. Like when you read through the story, a pilot who was not flying the plane anyway, he was getting a free ride on the plane, but had taken mushrooms like 2 or 3 days before and then was like, I have to take control of the plane. Like there are all the drug stories that started in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. They're still all out there, but we are much looser about psychedelics.
Well, before I answer that, because I have a thought about that.
Yeah.
In the 50s, when they were, LSD was given for free to different researchers, right? And some of the things they were doing are just absolutely horrifying. Like they would, Stan Grof, one of the great psychedelic avatars, he was strapped to an operating table in an operating room, given 1,000 micrograms of LSD, which is 10 times what anybody wants to say, and had a very bright light flashed in his eyes so they could study what was going on with his ocular nerve. Okay, I mean, that sounds to me like pure hell.
Yeah,
he continued to use psychedelics.
But then, as part of MK Ultra, Whitey Bulger, the criminal in the late 50s, was in a federal penitentiary in Atlanta, and he was dosed for like a month every day in solitary confinement without ever being told.
Happened. So no wonder terrible stories emerged. Okay, but the tipping point. One, science has really shown that these can be used very effectively and that one single dose can change people's lives, can eliminate depression for months, maybe years, maybe forever. So that's quite fascinating. Yeah. It's not a single everyday drug you have to take that blunts your affect. It doesn't take away all the color of life and leave you in this gray zone.
I will point out you are not you're not critical of SSRIs and other drugs, but it's like these operate differently.
They operate
psychedelics
completely differently.
Have the potential to help you shift without having to cut the highs and the lows.
Yeah, no, I'm not critical of SSRIs. Yeah. I'm not critical of alcohol.
Right.
I have used SSRIs for a few years in my life, and I continue to love alcohol. The third thing, though, is that we are in a crisis of mental health, of addiction. I mean, the problems, the sociological problems we're facing right now are extreme. And we don't, medicine and psychiatry hasn't given us much in the last 40 years. It's quite tragic, actually.
Right.
I think most psychiatrists, if they're honest, will tell you they're not really doing very much. Okay. I know a few who will say that at least. And we need these. We really need a new approach to healing these problems. And they're inexpensive. They can they can be used therapeutically. The key, though, is this therapeutic part, okay? One of the reasons the FDA didn't approve of MDA-assisted therapy is they didn't understand therapy. Okay. Why? I don't know. Okay, I don't understand what kind of mindset disables people from understanding that therapy is a useful thing or a useful adjunct to psychedelics. It baffles me. But there's that kind. Those people need some psychedelics because they need to open up their thinking about how healing happens.
And the idea with that, going back to how psychedelics are therapeutic, they open this window where you can kind of do a lot of therapeutic work quickly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will talk about taking MDMA, and it's like, you know, 7 years worth of therapy in an afternoon. But to be, you know, but MAPS, the group that was funding the MDMA studies that ended up failing last year, points out that it's therapy with MDMA. So they're not, even they who are a very drug-friendly crowd are saying, oh, yeah, this is, there are no magic bullets.
There are no magic bullets, and that the therapy, I mean, therapy, we need some more definition and some expansion mm-hmm. on how therapy actually works, right? Mm-hmm. Or what works, because there are other people I know who are running integration circles that you can join after you trip and that go on for weeks, sometimes mm-hmm. months, where it's very relational, right? Like, you talk to me about your experience, mm-hmm. I talk to you. We come to understandings through talking, through mm-hmm. through sharing. And I think that also, I mean, I don't think indigenous people worked that way. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think most studies I read or most stuff I've read doesn't really talk about that. But if you are in an indigenous community and you have a, say, a peyote experience, mm-hmm. the shamans are always there. They're like mm-hmm. in the house three doors down. Yeah. You can go and talk to them. And the community shares this ontology mm-hmm. of how life works, right? Mm-hmm. So they have a basis of understanding that we really don't have. Mm-hmm. So we are really establishing, quite interestingly, protocols for what to do,
right?
And one of the things that really I didn't explore in this book, but want to explore, is what are the modern rituals we can develop, mm-hmm. right, to help us make more sense of psychedelics mm-hmm. and this life on Earth, really?
Yeah,
yeah, and I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and it seems we have more time for that, right? Or it seems a more pressing question.
We really need to do that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's interesting, you had mentioned this before, you know, there are the plant-derived drugs, things like ayahuasca or ibogaine, even if they're synthesized ultimately and whatnot. And then there are the, you know, the real chemicals like LSD, which does come from a mold and all of that. But, you know, when people talk about things like land acknowledgments, which seem to be on the way out, it's like making a land acknowledgement wherever the Sandoz laboratory in Switzerland was is kind of interesting. But it's this incredibly powerful substance that kind of shows up. It doesn't, you know, it's dropped from the sky rather than emerging from religious ritual or social practice. So we need to figure out how do we make sense of it? How do we use it to make sense of our lives? How do we make sense of it?
Ketamine, LSD, mm-hmm. what's the third one? I guess mescaline, although mm-hmm. mescaline is derived from peyote. Right. MDMA.
Yeah.
These are the drugs of our culture,
mm-hmm.
and we have to create rituals to make them work better for us. I think that's, you know, come on, shrinks. Let's get to work here.
Well, maybe it's
open
not
your
shrinks,
eyes.
Right?
Maybe that's the next MAPS conference. Yeah. It's like, what are the rituals we can devise to help us make? Because, you know, going to a rave is great, but it isn't going to help you with your depression.
Right.
It may help you dance better.
Yeah.
Actually, Gul Dolan, the neuroscientist I mentioned before, she's doing work now with people who have had strokes. Her next experiments will explore if psychedelics can reopen that critical period to help people who have lost movement regain it.
Yeah.
And I keep thinking, all right, well, maybe going to a rave on MDMA if you've had a stroke may not be the worst idea, because you can move.
You pay a $30 copay and it's covered by insurance.
Right? Yeah. And maybe you can move a little better afterwards.
I want to come back to the future of psychedelics or of the legal status and how we, you know, what are different ways that these things can be regulated, you know, either by people or by governments or companies. But first, real quick, let's talk a little bit about your career. You mentioned before that you wrote the book Brave New Weed a few years ago. I interviewed you for that, and that was fantastic, because as legal weed came into being, you talked about how, like, suddenly we have this vast variety of different types of weed and different. I mean, it's the difference between wine in like 2000 and wine in America in 1970.
Yeah,
where it was just like, I want red or white or rosé, which is a mix of the two, and they come in gallon jugs with comically Italian last names on it, right? Carla exactly. Rossi or whatever. And then, you know, we became much more sophisticated about our palate. Brave New Weed is really kind of about that and all the different purposes. You earlier in your career, you were a journalist at Condé Nast. You were the editor of Details magazine, RIP. How does your journalism career and shift into executive coaching and then ultimately writing books about drugs, does this parallel what we've been doing as a society in any way?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly not a great career move. I mean, like my executive coaching and my presentation training has very little to do with these books. However, I will say that a lot of the people that I do coach are really interested in psychedelics. Mm-hmm. They're younger, they're running companies, they're highly stressed out. Mm-hmm. They use psychedelics and they want to know how to use them more mindfully because they need resets. They call it a reset. They're very into optimizing. I'm sort of unoptimizing. Like I don't want to be optimized anymore. I'm too old for optimization. Okay, I've passed my optimizing phase. I want to de-optimize, actually. Right. I want to feel more wonder and awe into the world. What was the question about my career?
Well, I guess, Details was, you know, the magazine of downtown New York, certainly in the 80s, in its heyday. It does not exist anymore. It was purchased by Condé Nast. Which kind of, I mean, exists obviously, but that's kind of like a lumbering, ruin of, in lower Manhattan, right? I mean, was about clubs. It was about downtown
that
culture.
That version of Details was the version I worked for was a young men's style magazine. Mm-hmm. And actually some of the people that I edited, Eric Davis or Doug Rushkoff, who are now writing about psychedelics in big ways and also doing other things, we're writing for Details. So we wrote about drugs, we wrote about raves, we wrote about sex, we wrote about things that a lot of magazines were resistant to approach, right? And,
do you feel like
we were punished for it?
Well, also, you succeeded, right?
We succeeded, but we were punished.
I mean, Details was one of those magazines that really kind of, led the way for all sorts of kind of culture magazines for both men and women.
I thought so.
Do you feel like we're just more comfortable than we used to be with the idea that we're going to use drugs to achieve a desired state?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, just the fact that you and I are sitting here talking about it, talking about our own experiences, we're not really afraid of the feds coming down on us.
That's right.
Everybody we know has use some drug mostly, and then you have things that come out like Ozempic, which are, life-saving and life-changing. And, we've seen the difference in front of our eyes.
Yeah.
So it's quite accepted now. Are you working on a piece on this?
I'm working on a documentary about this. So
how
it's drugs a little bit
we, how we all just accept drugs.
Yeah, I mean, we're developing a profoundly different relationship to drugs, both legal and illegal, and partly that we're putting them all on the same kind of spectrum now, because the question is, I want to feel a certain way, I want to look a certain way, I want to behave a certain way.
What can I take?
What can I use? And I don't care as much, as I might have in 1975.
No, definitely not.
You know, this is legal, this is not.
So one thing I found interesting in my life is that a lot of people who use drugs know nothing about them.
Yeah.
And they don't care.
If I may plump for the preface to your book, it's written by Julie Holland, a doctor, a psychiatrist, an MD, who writes and does a lot of research about drugs, and she points out that you would just take whatever anybody gave you, and they would say, hey, take this, it's really good. And you would take it and find out, which seems insane today.
However, when your doctor gives you a script, and this is the smartest people I know, they're getting scripts, and I'll say, okay, so what are the side effects? They go, I don't know.
Yeah.
I said, why? You didn't ask? No, I didn't ask.
Yeah.
Or the doctor didn't know, which is often the case, because so many drugs are coming out, they can't keep up. And I think it is very beneficial to know what goes with what, what doesn't go with what, because those can be really unpleasant experiences, and they can fuck you up.
Yeah.
But I mean, the fact that we can sit here and talk about this now, I think is a great reason to continue your project, because we're all using different
And it seems,
molecules.
I mean, we are being, whether we're being forced to or we choose to accept agency, where it's like, it's my life, it's my body, it's my mind, it's my mood, I'm going to take care of it because nobody's coming.
No one's coming. There's no savior. There's no magic here. Although I think there is some magic in psychedelics. That's the other thing. To go back to the very first question, they are magical. I mean, they enable you to see things that you just don't see every day. It's like, so my young nephew who went to Berkeley during COVID was tripping a lot. And I said, why? And he said, well, we can't go anywhere outside. Yeah. I might as well go inside. Yeah. And I thought, you know what? That is a really smart answer.
That is a great answer.
Go for it.
So let's look to the future. We've taken our magic mushrooms and our ibogaine and everything else. One of the odd things is a Republican president in the early 70s, Richard Nixon, declared war on drugs. He called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America. Sent up a manhunt for him, etc. Flash forward to now, we have another Republican president in the White House, Donald Trump, who has put as Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a former, confessed former junkie, heroin junkie, who takes testosterone or male growth hormone. He's on a regimen of lots of drugs, but not heroin anymore, thank God. And he doesn't drink. But he's talked a lot about making psychedelics medically available or recreationally available. What do you think? What is the operating window here for the optimal change window for psychedelics either being legalized, decriminalized, medicalized?
Yes, and yes. Yeah. I don't think they're going to be legalized. I think they will be medicalized because that's our modality. And I'm hopeful, but also worried about it. Who is going to control these substances? And are ICE agents going to be getting them? And what is that going to mean? And I mean, it's sort of mind-boggling. And I worry that the people in control don't know enough to really be able to figure out how to use them. Will they even fit in our so-called healthcare system? How can they fit in this system that is so broken anyway? I don't get it. Yeah. I don't know how that's going to play. I'm not an oracle about this.
Do you feel
like... But I really think smart people need to start thinking about it. And we need people who understand psychedelics to also... Like, we need Julie on a thought committee. RFK, in a way, I sort of am like, yeah, okay, let's move on with this.
Well, it's amazing to think of somebody like him who is anti-vaccine broadly.
I know.
So he wants to shut down that type of drug, but he might be saying, okay, you can't get the MMR vaccine anymore, but here's a bunch of psychedelics.
Here's some MDMA.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's just baffling. And
it's very psychedelic, actually. Donald Trump becomes... I can imagine him in Dayglow as a Dayglow, Goodyear blimp dropping acid from the sky, right? Like
he's a man who doesn't even drink, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So it's
or smoke.
We are in, another period of alliances changing.
Yeah.
And I am so not the man to predict how this is going to play out.
And then when we talk about who controls things, we live in a world where the federal government ultimately dictates and says this drug is Schedule One, which means it's has high potential for abuse and no known medical use, which includes pot, oddly. But so we're going to ban it completely. That's not good, right?
I mean, don't we need to rethink the scheduling system, at least for psychedelics? It's insane.
Totally,
it just makes no sense.
But then you worry a bit if it's insurance companies or if it's the medical establishment or if it's shaman who are saying like, I have a excuse me, a long-lived cultural relationship with this drug by dint of where I come from or what my heritage is, so I get to do this drug or tell you when you can do it. Is the best way forward a kind of legalize them all?
Or it's again another reason I wrote the book is like, no matter what happens, people are going to use these substances, okay? And they need to we need to figure out how to use them. That's what's best for you and what's best for me, right? SAMHSA just released information, right, that the number of people who've used psychedelics in the last 4 or 5 years has gone up 50% from 2.4 of the population to 3.1. That's a lot. I mean, those are, they sound
tiny. Is that for like past year?
I think it was since 2001. Okay. I think it was 4 years. Okay. I'm not, don't quote me though. Okay? Okay. I was just reading this the other day and I didn't clock it really. But that's a big leap of people.
Although it's still a small absolute number.
It is.
But this is, you know, COVID started out small, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well put. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it may be small, but that's a leap.
Right.
And certainly people we know are using them more and more and more frequently. As I said to you, in my business, people I'm working with every day, they find out what I'm doing. And okay, when we're done with the official call, can we have another call about a retreat I want to go on?
Things will be made better. I mean, one of the great things about the book is that you talk about, I mean, you can't say, here's a list of my dealers or anything like that, nor would you. But, you know, you talk about how do you source these substances, many of, you know, almost all of which are illegal, at least at the federal level. And that is also puts a lot of responsibility on the individual, right?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, knowing how to, again, one of the most useful things are these little digital scales that cost $20, knowing how to measure, knowing what the right dose is. There's these new tests that have come out. I wrote about Q-tests in the book. They were expensive. They were about $25 a test, and they test purity and potency. But now another one has come out that's half the price.
Which is amazing because all of this is happening for a black or gray market.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we were, if things were loosened up a little bit, and then we would have better information, better sources.
Shouldn't we?
Yeah, better discussions.
Should we not have that? Yeah. I mean, you know, there's organizations like Dance Safe that show up at raves and people can test their substances and learn about them. And gosh, shouldn't that be pretty prevalent?
Yeah.
Really?
If as you point out, I mean, it's happening whether the man likes it or not.
It's just happening. It's everywhere. It's and not only in the United States. You know, in England, they have almost every rave in England has a table of, I forget the name of the organization, though, that makes themselves very available to you, very helpful. One of the greatest experiences of my life was at Burning Man. A friend in my camp was severely dehydrated. It was Tutu Tuesday, so I was wearing a tutu, and he couldn't. He had lost all connection to who he was. I took him to the emergency tent at Burning. Have you ever been to Burning Man?
Yes.
Did you know that there was an emergency
tent? Yes, I do.
Staffed by unbelievable doctors and nurses and just incredible humans.
All volunteers.
All volunteering, knowing they're going to go out to the playa that evening. This was during the day.
Right.
And I sat there with Michael for, 6 hours as he got a whole bunch of fluids pumped into his body in a tutu wrapped in a blanket. But I watched these burners, medical burners, treat people who were just in different states of distress, really. Lovingly, of their own time, of their own volition. And it was one of the best experiences of Burning Man I've ever had, because it's people taking care of people, right? And I think that's part of what psychedelic culture has spawned.
Yeah.
And I think it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and well, hopefully we'll be seeing more of it.
Hopefully we will.
Joe Dolce, thank you for talking to Reason. The book is Modern Psychedelics, The Handbook for Mindful Exploration.
Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate your attention and your time, and for reading my book.